at a junction that told the story of two brothers who had robbed a stagecoach up north of Mason. And about the time they got to the Llano River, the Texas Rangers caught up with them and dispatched one of them permanently to wherever his abode was destined to be. The other brother got away. And a story is told about that other brother. And I don't know whether this story is true, but it works with the lesson this morning, so I'm going to tell it like it was. And the story is that surviving brother went to a local preacher and said that he wanted his brother buried in a fine service, and he had plenty of money from other things that he hadn't been caught for, and so he was going to make a big donation to the church in return for the pastor eulogizing his dead outlaw brother and saying at least one time during the service he was a saint. Now, the pastor was a man of great rectitude, and he wasn't prepared to do that, and the living brother told him that if he didn't do it, he was going to burn down his church. And if he did do it, he'd make him a present of $1,000 for the church. And so the pastor said that he would find some way to work that into the eulogy. So the time for the eulogy came, and the service was taking place, and the coffin was there in the front of the church, and the surviving brother was sitting right here where Ben Ditto is this morning. And the pastor launched into the eulogy by saying, "The man who died was the biggest scoundrel who has ever been seen in Kimball County. As a matter of fact, there was probably no crime that he didn't commit. He was a robber. He was a murderer. He was an extortionist. He used to beat up kids in the first grade to get their lunch money. He's just the worst kind of person you could possibly imagine." And the brother in the front row was just livid. He couldn't believe the guy had turned on him like that. But he said, "The preacher, I want to tell you that as bad as that rascal was, compared with his brother here, he was a saint." I was reading this week something that contained a quote by Carl Sandburg. I don't know whether you've read Sandburg's biographies of Lincoln or not. They're marvelous. And when Lincoln died, Sandburg quoted an old woodsman's aphorism, which is, "A tree is best measured when it's down. A tree is best measured when it's down." And I don't think there's any better way to measure Joseph than when he is down. And we're going to see Joseph this morning literally on his deathbed. We've said that Abraham is remembered as the friend of God, David a man after God's heart, and Joseph, by the very brief statement, God was with him. God was with him. And I wondered this week as I was working on this lesson, what difference does that make? So what that God was with him? He's down now. He's just about ready to die. Joseph remembered, of course, as a man of great faith. I remember Ray Stedman saying, "A faith that fails before the finish was faulty from the first." And I wondered how Joseph's faith was going to hold up now as we reach the end of his life. Joseph is an old man. He has been around for an awful long time. One of the commentators remarked, 110 years had stolen away his strength, had left deep marks on his form. It was 93 years since he had been lifted from the pit into which his brothers had cast him in order to become a slave. 80 years had passed since he had first stood before Pharaoh in all the beauty and wisdom of his young manhood. 60 years had left their papyrus records in the state archives, since with all the pomp and splendor of Egypt's court, he had carried the remains of his old father Joseph back to Canaan. He was old when he saw the bright young faces of his great-grandchildren there upon his knees. With long life and many days, God had blessed his faithful servant, and now, stopping beneath their weight, he was fast descending to the breakup of natural life. How would we measure the life of someone like Joseph? We have to be careful by what standard we use, because the standard will tell a lot about who we are. When Talleyrand came in the latter part of the 18th century to the United States, he was amazed because the standard that everyone used to measure people's lives was how much money they'd made. Not what sort of life they lived, but how much money they made. Not too much unlike today. I have a friend who, just about any time you ask him about somebody, he asks, he's such a sports nut, he said, who did he play for? The question then is, what kind of a standard are we going to use to measure the life of this man? A friend of mine here in the class gave me an article last week from Newsweek magazine that speaks of values and how we measure people. Current presidential election was a referendum on American values, the author says. The candidate who most clearly represented our collective vision was the one who was elected. But what are the values behind this vision? We like to think, families and fireplaces and front porches and swings and a picture-perfect landscape where people sit down to eat together, where old folks live at home and young folks don't talk back. We value friendship and thrift. We value history and tradition, culture and continuity. We value childhood, baseball games on hot summer nights, and high school reunions and holidays. It's a healthy and happy vision, but like most of the fantasies conjured up in our lives today, it doesn't really exist, not really in the America of the 80s. The trouble is, real American values are expressed not by what we say we wish for, but what we really do. We love our families, but we can't count many friends with intact ones anymore. We love our old people, but not for more than an hour or two at a time. They don't care much for us either. They seem to prefer the child-free retirement communities to life and extended families. We are a people full of compassion, but extends more freely to three trapped whales than to homeless people huddled over heat grates. We love our children, but how many children come home to empty houses during the day? We believe in families, but how many families sit down to eat together anymore? And although more of us today say we believe in God, how many really attend church regularly? What are America's values? And then she continues, look who our heroes are. They aren't the people who volunteer in the soup kitchens. They aren't struggling writers and artists. They aren't the librarians or nurses or social workers. Mainly, they are the rich and the famous and the successful and the beautiful, the film and sports stars, Wall Street barons, even the articulate convicts who charm us on talk shows once they've done their time. Perhaps the best indicator of what we really are is what we spend our money on, or what we watch on television. Look at what we read. Look at what we choose to do with our spare time. That's what we value. I've often thought that if I were brave enough to give you my logbook and my checkbook, you could write my biography. Because if you knew how I spent my time and how I spent my money, you would know who I was. If I told you who my heroes were, you could tell what kind of a person I was likely to be. Another place where values are reflected are in obituaries. I read one in the New York Times this morning of a well-known lawyer who died this past week in New York. He had had a senior place in one of the recent presidential administrations. And in a very long article, it spoke of all of his business accomplishments, the people he had known. It spoke of the clubs that he had belonged to and the charities that he had dealt with. If you wrote your own obituary today, what would you want to put in it? If you wrote Joseph's obituary, how would you write it? We've been studying his life now for the past several weeks and months. How would you write Joseph's obituary? Maybe it might be something like this, if you were an enterprising reporter for the Cairo Times. Cairo, 5 March 1800 BC. After a brief illness, Joseph Jacob's son, former prime minister of Egypt, died today in his villa on the Nile. He was 110 years old. Mr. Jacob's son, who served as prime minister during the reign of Pharaoh Unknown Hotep, was widely regarded for his administrative skills and is perhaps best remembered for his work during the famous 7 years famine, when he was named as food and grain czar to the Pharaoh. Some historians feel that he stood second only to Pharaoh in the government of his day, with unlimited authority in the area of food distribution and taxation. Others believe this view is exaggerated, since he was known to have come to Egypt as a Hebrew slave while still a young man. Nevertheless, his was a true life rags-to-riches story and could serve as an inspiration to the ambitious young Egyptian of today. Having risen from obscurity to the peak of power and influence in government, he still found time for civic work. Among his many posts, he served as president of the Cairo Chamber of Commerce, was life member of Downtown Rotary, was founder of the Lower Nile River Water Authority, and chaired the fund drive which raised over 2 million shekels for the restoration of the Sphinx. Famous for his sense of humor, he was credited with writing history's first limerick. The Pharaoh, while dining at Heath, once sat on a set of false teeth. Said he with a start, "Oh my, bless my heart, I've bitten myself underneath." Mr. Jacobson was married to the former Asenath Potipharah, daughter of the priest of On, survived by 2 sons, numerous grandchildren and great-grandchildren. His extended family includes the descendants of his brothers and forms the large and growing Hebrew colony that has settled in the land of Goshen. It must be added here that the size of this colony has raised serious national security issues in official quarters, and highly placed administration sources have said that the government has developed contingency plans to deal with the situation posed by the Hebrews. The family has requested that in lieu of flowers, donations be sent to your favorite charity. Embalming arrangements are being handled by Mummy Wrap, Inc., who take pride in their motto, "We'll be the last ones to let you down." How do you suppose God would have written that obituary? Because God did write an obituary of Joseph. Joseph is the subject of 13 chapters in the Old Testament, but only passing reference is made to him in the New Testament. And the only value judgment that is made about Joseph in the New Testament is in the book of Hebrews, the 11th chapter and the 22nd verse. Is the obituary that God wrote for Joseph. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones. Now, we're going to look this morning at what Joseph said and what God did, and then what Joseph was. The passage divides very neatly into those three sections because what Joseph said on his deathbed was a result of what God had done in his life. And what God did made him what he was. So let's look first at what Joseph said. Turn with me to the 50th chapter of the book of Genesis, the first book in the Bible, and the last chapter in that book. And the 22nd verse of the 50th chapter concludes the story of Joseph. Genesis 50, 22. Joseph stayed in Egypt along with all his father's family. He lived 110 years and saw the third generation of Ephraim's children. Also, the children of Machir, son of Manasseh, were placed at birth on Joseph's knees. You recall that Ephraim and Manasseh were his 2 children. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land to the land he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And Joseph made the sons of Israel swear an oath and said, "God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up from this place." So Joseph died at the age of 110, and after they embalmed him, he was placed in a coffin in Egypt. The book of Genesis opens with 4 words and closes with 4 words. The opening 4 words, of course, are, "In the beginning, God." And the closing 4 words are, "A coffin in Egypt." In the beginning, God. What a marvelous, bright statement, full of the promise to come of all of God's creation. A coffin in Egypt. What a gloomy close to a book. How could such a bright beginning lead to such a gloomy ending? Is that what we're about here, bright beginnings and gloomy endings? Rudyard Kipling, in a cynical mood, wrote a brief poetic statement about what it was like for a Westerner to go into the East and try to compete effectively. He said, "The end of the fight is a tombstone, white, with the name of the late deceased and an epitaph drear. A fool lies here who tried to hustle the East." What about, do you remember a movie that Kirk Douglas made called Young Man with a Horn, where a trumpet player searched all of his life for a certain sound in the trumpet, never could find it, and only finally heard it in the wail of the siren that was carrying him to the hospital where he would die? Is that what we're about here? Is that all there is, bright beginnings and gloomy endings? There was a popular song a few years ago called "Is That All There Is?" If that's all there is, then keep on dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball, if that's all there is. And if that's all there is, then maybe all that counts in your obituary is how much money you've made and the clubs you've been a member of and the boards you've served on. Joseph saw something of the futility of life when he said to his brothers, "I am about to die." In the Hebrew, according to the commentaries, that means, boys, there is no question about it. I am for sure getting ready to die. For all of us, the statistics are what? 1 out of 1. Chances are 100% that we're going to finally come to the place that Joseph came to. But in the face of the apparent futility which death confronts all of us with, Joseph had an assurance and a reminder that is introduced by two powerful words. Do you see those words in verse 24? "I am about to die." Here they are. "But God." But God. And then he goes on to say, "God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land." Now, how did he know that? Well, he knew that because it was tradition in his family that was going to happen. Do you remember when we were studying the life of Abraham back over in the 15th chapter? Abraham had a vision. And in the 15th chapter in the 12th verse, as the sun was setting, Abraham fell into a deep sleep. A thick and dreadful darkness came over him. The Lord said to him, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated 400 years. Speaking of the time that the Hebrews would be enslaved in Egypt before the Exodus. "But," here it is again, that marvelous word, "but I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterwards you will come out with great possessions." That's the assurance. Joseph says to his brothers, "You remember the tradition of your great-grandfather Abraham, your grandfather Isaac, your father Jacob? God is going to come to your aid." The great word of assurance. Now, Joseph knew his brothers, and he knew what they were like, because they're like we are. And he knew that with a word of assurance, he was going to have to give them a reminder of God's faithfulness. Verse 25 of chapter 50 said, "I want you to swear to me that you will," what? "Carry my bones up from this place. Don't leave me here. Take me with you when you go." Meyer has a comment about that, which is to the point. He says that these unburied bones must have been a marvelous lesson for the nation of Israel when they were finally put into slavery after Joseph's death and the taskmasters dealt harshly with the people so that their hearts fainted. It must have been sweet to go and look at that mummy case that held those decaying remains waiting there to be carried forward. And as they did so, there was doubtless this reflection on their part. Evidently, then, Joseph believed that we were not to stay here always, but that we should sooner or later leave for Canaan. Let's brace ourselves, bury it a little longer. It may be only a very little while. You know, Joseph was an intensely practical guy. We've seen him as one of the foremost administrators of his day. How can we get a handle on what kind of faith it takes to make that kind of a statement on your deathbed? Think for a minute, what if George Washington had said something like what Joseph said? Boys, don't bury me permanently here in Mount Vernon. I want you to put me in a situation where after a certain period of time has passed, you can take my coffin and everybody in the United States is going to go back to the mother country. Those of you who come from Ireland originally will go back to Ireland, and those that come from Northern Europe will go there, and those who've come over from Africa will go there. Just bear my bones with you. And now it's 200 years later, and we're still all around, and nobody's gone back to Africa, and nobody's gone back to Ireland, and old George is still up there in the coffin in Mount Vernon. And what would we think about that? Well, we'd think old George must have been squirrely. I mean, who wants to go back to Northern Ireland anyway? But the Hebrews believed, because of Joseph's deep faith, that it was God who had, in their particular case, told them to wait. And the reminder of his faithfulness, that is, God's faithfulness, were to be Joseph's unburied bones. So he gave them an assurance of God's faithfulness and a reminder of that faithfulness in those unburied bones, all based on his complete trust, of course, in God. Now, what was that trust based on? What is it that God had done? That's what Joseph said. Let's look at our second point. What was it that God had done to build that kind of faith and trust into the life of Joseph? Well, I want to suggest to you reverently, friends, that what God had done was he had mugged Joseph. Now, I use the word in the original Old English sense that Webster's talked about. Mugged originally meant an unexpected blow. And if there was ever an example in Scripture of a man whose life had been full of unexpected blows, blows that God had allowed life to deal him, it was surely Joseph. Let's imagine a conversation between Joseph and God in the prison after he has been languishing there for years. And God, let's suppose, comes to Joseph and says, Joseph, how did you feel that day when your brothers threw you into the pit? Did you feel helpless? Yeah, Lord, I sure did. Good. Joseph, how did you feel when they sold you into slavery? Did you feel helpless? Yeah, Lord, I got to say I did. Good. Joseph, how did you feel when Potiphar bought you like a piece of meat and made you a houseboy? And he said, boy, go do this. And boy, come do that. How did you feel, Joseph? Did you feel helpless? Yes, Lord, I got to confess I did. Good. Joseph, how did you feel when Potiphar's wife falsely accused you of rape and nobody believed your side of the story? Did you feel helpless? Yes, sir. Good. How did you feel, Joseph, when you were convicted of a crime that you didn't commit and you were thrown into prison with no hope of parole ever? Did you feel helpless? Yes, I did. Good. How did you feel when you befriended an official of Pharaoh's administration right there in that prison? He was released from prison, and he, with one word to Pharaoh, could have gotten you out, and instead he forgot you the way you forget a stray dog. How did you feel about that, Joseph? Did you feel helpless? Yes, sir, I got to say I felt helpless. Good. So there you are, Joseph, today, on rotting prison straw, without a friend in the world and absolutely without hope of release. How do you feel, Joseph? Lord, I feel helpless. Read my lips. Helpless. And God replies, good. Now, that means you have to rely utterly on my strength and not yours, doesn't it? Right? Of course, right. Sometimes God sounds Jewish when he's talking, you know? And now he says to Joseph that we got that settled. We can begin to use you in our work. So get up. Change your shirt. I'm going to make you prime minister of Egypt. Don't thank me. It's going to be a lot of work, and the in-laws are going to be on you like you won't believe. What was it that God did to Joseph to build that kind of faith? He mugged him just like he did Paul. You remember what Paul said in 2 Corinthians? He said, we don't want you to be ignorant, brethren, of the hardships we have suffered in Asia. He said, we have been so utterly, unbearably crushed that we despaired of life itself. He said, I felt like I had received the sentence of death. But then he says what the reason for that is. He said, that was to make us rely not on ourselves, but on the God who raises the dead. Paul would have understood Joseph because both of them had been mugged by life and what God allowed to happen in their lives. And I think the reason for that was that God saw it was very important that they be trained to trust. Trained to trust. God took the trouble to train them to trust Him. I was down on a friend's ranch a couple of years ago, and we were having dinner, and I heard a knock at the door. There wasn't anybody there but us, late, and he said, I'll get it, it's just Molly. And he went over and he opened the door, and it was a deer. And I said, do you normally have deer come calling this time of the night? And I mean, the deer just walked right into the living room, and he went to the pantry and got some deer food and put it in a little bowl. The deer stood right there and ate while we did. I said, how is that possible? He said, oh, we found her when she was just a fawn, almost frozen to death. Mother had apparently abandoned her. Boy, mugged by life, that deer was. And we trained her to trust us. And now when she gets hungry, she's just a wild animal. But when she gets hungry, she comes and she knocks on the door. And we let her in and we feed her. Trained to trust. Isn't that marvelous? But you know, we're not only trained to trust, we have to practice it every day. Because even when we get the hang of it, we forget. So we need reminders. What did Joseph say on his deathbed? Well, he gave his brothers an assurance of God's faithfulness, and then he gave him a reminder of his own unburied bones. Why was he so certain of that? Because like Paul, God had allowed life to mug him, to strike him with a series of unexpected blows. Unexpected blows from God that trained them to trust in God. Well, that's what Joseph said, and that's what God did. Let's look now quickly and see what Joseph was as a result of all of that, and then we'll be ready to write our own version of Joseph's obituary. Here's what I'd put in Joseph's obituary. First, four things. Loving and obedient son of his father. Chapter 43 of Genesis and the 27th verse speaks of what Joseph asked them, the brothers, when they first came to Egypt. And having returned, he said, how is your aged father you told me about? Is he still living? His concern for his dad was great. He expresses it so many places in the scripture. We've seen it together. And then in the 45th chapter and the 13th verse, he said to his brothers as he sent them back after he had revealed himself, tell my father about the honor accorded me in Egypt and about everything you have seen, and bring my father here quickly. He said, go tell dad that it's okay, that I'm doing fine, and bring him on down. I just can't wait to see him. 45th chapter and the 23rd verse. This is what he sent to his father. 10 donkeys loaded with the best things of Egypt. 10 female donkeys loaded with grain. And then finally the 46th chapter and the 29th verse. The marvelous reunion of the two. Jacob sent Judah ahead to Joseph to get directions to Goshen when they arrived in the region of Goshen. Joseph had his chariot made ready, and he went to Goshen to meet his father Israel. I'll bet those horses got to work out that day. As soon as Joseph appeared before him, he threw his arms around his father, and he wept for a long time. He was a loving and obedient son to his father. You looking forward to a reunion with your dad? Maybe your dad's still living. Mine's been gone for a number of years now, but I'm looking forward to that reunion. There's going to be some hugging going on, and some laughing, and some crying too. And then we're just going to sit and talk about some things that we didn't get said when he was here. Joseph was a loving and obedient son of his father. The second thing I'd say about him in his obituary was that he was a forgiving and generous brother of his family. The 45th chapter says that after he had identified himself to his brothers, "I'm your brother Joseph, you sold me into Egypt, but don't be distressed and don't be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you." And then on down in that same chapter, the 10th and the 11th verses, come to the region of Goshen, be near me, you, your children, grandchildren, flocks, herds, all you have, I'll provide for you there, because 5 years of famine are still to come." Very generous, open-hearted, forgiving man with his brothers. And then the 50th chapter, when his father has died and the brothers are afraid that now that Jacob is gone, Joseph might change his mind and become vindictive, Joseph said, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended it to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children." And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. The commentators say that phrase, "spoke kindly," means he spoke heart to heart. A very intimate, personal, deep level of communication with the brothers who had wronged him. He was a loving and obedient son to his father, I'd say, goes in his obituary, and also a forgiving and generous brother of his family. Third, of course, a wise and trusted subject of his Pharaoh. Chapter 41 reminds us of what it was like when he stood before Pharaoh, interpreted the dream, and he told Pharaoh that he needed to find himself a good man to implement this program of gathering and storing and finally distributing food during the good years so they'd be prepared for the bad years. Plan seemed good to Pharaoh, verse 37 says. And Pharaoh asked him, "Where can we find anyone like this person who's being described? One in whom is the Spirit of God?" And then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt." Joseph was a Jew. Pharaoh was a pagan. And yet Joseph served him loyally for many, many years. I read this week Soviet writer in the wake of Gorbachev's perestroika and glasnost has said, "Communism is a system under which everyone has a job and nobody works." That doesn't characterize any of us in this room, I know. Because as Christians, we're meant to be stewards. Stewards not only of the material things God gives us, but the responsibilities that he places on us. Do you work for a non-Christian boss? I hope that you're giving that boss every day, every moment, 60 seconds worth of distance run. Joseph did, because he was not only a loving and obedient son of his father and a forgiving and generous brother of his family, but he was a wise and trusted subject of his Pharaoh. But then fourth and most important, he was a faithful and humble servant of his God. When he told the brothers who he was, they were astounded. He kept telling them, "Don't worry about it. It's going to be okay. You intended it for evil. God intended it for good." In the following paragraph, he uses God's name four times. He said, "Don't be angry. It was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives. It was not you who sent me, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh, lord of his entire household. Go tell my dad, this is what your son Joseph said. God has made me lord of all of Egypt." Joseph had developed the sensitivity so trained by the blows that God allowed life to rain on his poor head that he could see God's hand in everything. And he was thereby a faithful and humble servant of his God. Well, we said that a tree is best measured when it's down. Joseph is down. He has been laid out and placed in a coffin in Egypt. Is that all there is? Just a bright beginning and the futility of life being expressed by a coffin in Egypt? Let's reset the type on our obituary before we go to press. Cairo, 5 March, 1800 BC. After a brief illness, Joseph Jacobson, former prime minister of Egypt, died today in his villa on the Nile. He was 110 years old. Mr. Jacobson, who served as prime minister during the reign of Pharaoh Amenhotep, was widely regarded for his administrative skills and is perhaps best remembered as a loving and obedient son to his father, a forgiving and generous brother of his family, a wise and trusted subject of Pharaoh, a faithful and humble servant of his God. And this is the epitaph that is to be placed on his sarcophagus. He was trained to trust, and God was with him. I've got two so whats as we close. Sitting in the office yesterday thinking about this, and the first so what is this. For their assurance, Joseph's family heard Joseph say, God will come. For our assurance, we have Jesus who says, I have come. For their reminder, Joseph's family had his unburied bones. For our reminder, we have Jesus' empty tomb. And then last, I have to tell you that my reaction yesterday afternoon about 3 o'clock as I sat and looked at this life of this great man of God was this. Lord, that's wonderful. That's inspirational. That's hopeless. I will never have that kind of faith. I can relate to David because David was always fouling up, but this guy was always doing the right thing. It's absolutely impossible that I will ever be like that. As a matter of fact, I feel so helpless that I feel like I'm in jail. And then it was almost as if I heard a voice say, how do you feel? Helpless? Good. That means you have to rely utterly on my strength and not yours, right? Of course, right. Now that we got that settled, I can begin to use you. So get up and change your shirt. We've got things to do. Don't thank me, it's a lot of work. And the in-laws are going to move on you like crazy. Let's thank him. Father, today we thank you for the life of Joseph. He sets before us a picture of faithfulness that is intimidating and sometimes almost beyond our ability to relate to. And we thank you for that intimidation, Father, because once again it brings you into our view on your great and mighty throne where we stand helpless before you. And we hear you say, helpless, good. Now I can use you because you will rely utterly on my strength and not your own. And we thank you for that in Jesus' name. Amen.